Even the president saw it, but in a move that is not a complete surprise, he looked directly at the sun without any glasses. Perhaps the most impressive thing any president's ever done.
It's Thursday, August 24th, 2017. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. I'm Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our capital muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And Sean is back from the Great Left Coast and ready to rumble. On this week's show, reflecting on Charlottesville, is it time for regime change in the U.S.? If the organization Refuse Fascism has anything to say about it, November 4th is go time. Boston is still strong and Phoenix is rising in resistance to neo-Nazis and the alt-right. Alt-right celebrities and anti-Muslim organizations cancel rallies and retreat to their internet safe spaces. Trump continues to be Trump. Business leaders bail on his manufacturing council. Bannon forced out? Or maybe he's just finished what he needed to do inside the White House. Now it's back to Breitbart to pressure from the outside. Senator Soprano, Scott Wagner, mimics Trump, forgetting to condemn Nazi violence in Charlottesville. The big question remains, does he have black friends too? We'll find out. Philly, Lancaster, Carlisle, Doylestown, and other PA cities draw thousands in solidarity with Charlottesville and resistance to fascism. PA Student Power Network holds first statewide leadership training retreat ahead of the start of the school year. Pennsylvania has the largest number of anti-government militias in the U.S. We're number one, folks. Sean survives the E-Town Fair. And Daryl Metcalf just couldn't take the heat. So he blocked Sean on Twitter.
Daryl Metcalf.
Open records challenge coming soon. We shall see. And in today's last call, we'll be talking staring at the sun during the eclipse, space, and of course, beer. It's a reminder to tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. I'll be there giving the weekly resistance report once again. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org, or you can tune in on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or with the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you missed the show, no problem. Go to thericksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech TV icon in the sidebar. Remember, folks, we need you to help keep Pull No Punches Progressive Media going strong. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to ragingchickenpress.org and look for the Support and Membership tab. Click Become a Member and you're on your way. Not ready to become a member? No problem. You can make a one-time donation by clicking Donate. We need you, the progressive community, to help keep, you know, help keep us going strong and help us deepen Pull No Punches Progressive Media. That will hold power accountable. And right now, big announcement, folks. We've got the back-to-school special run-in. If you join now through October at the $10 a month level, we will send you a copy of Mark Bray's new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. That's right. It is slated to come off the presses any day now. We hope to, we got some advanced copies coming. We hope to be doing a review. We got some feelers out to try to get him on the program. And we are going to make this available to you if you join Raging Chicken Press at the $10 per month level. Right? Let us know. We need the membership. We need to deepen this. We need to hire more writers. And you need to read this book. So here we are, Sean. We are back, man.
Yeah, you know, it's great to be back. You know, I felt like I brought this California weather back with me. You know, it's a couple of sticky, hot, humid days out here in the central part of the state. But now I'm getting ready to take my air conditioner out of the window.
Yeah, man, it's it definitely seems to have the weather break, although I hate to even say that for fear that there will be return of humidity. But right now it looks like pretty freaking awesome for the next few days, at least where I sit and where you sit.
Yeah, you know, one thing I'd like to say is I survived the E-Town Fair last night. I went out, I ventured out of the Harrisburg bubble and into the yonder and had a really fun time.
That's awesome. Did you eat anything?
No, I just stayed there. I'm working on a really awesome story. I know we've been back and forth on this a couple of times. But I went out to Eat Town to go gather some interviews with people out there and work on a story that might be out in a few weeks.
But you didn't eat anything. That's the big...
No, I didn't. No corn dogs. I did not pull a Michelle Bachmann or a Mitt Romney and eat a corn dog.
Illogical.
How can you go to a fair and not eat anything?
Illogical.
I know. Instead, I came back and had a burger at McGrath's that I was looking forward to, so...
Yes, and just lost yourself in reflection, so... that's good. So, I mean...
I was more concerned about my car. You know, I had to park on a side street because I wasn't paying like $10 for parking out there or $5 for parking. And, you know, it's a very conservative area. And my car, if you've seen the back of it, has a Bernie Sanders sticker, a DSA sticker, and a few other very far left-leaning bumper stickers on there. So I was worried that my car is going to come back. I was going to come back to my car 4 flat tires.
Well, you know, I think you got that one bumper sticker, right, that says, I'm so far left, I'm right, right? Because that's, I mean, it's the same thing, right? I mean, the farthest left you go, yeah, it's the big horseshoe, right? I mean, so I'm sure you got that sticker on your car, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but your car was all right at the end?
Yeah, I made it back safely.
You know, they took one look at that car and they're like, yeah, it's not worth it.
The 2002 Nissan Sentra.
There you go. All right, man. Well, so it's been, man, a lot's gone on. And I was so great that we were able to kind of get you on for a little bit last week to do the little California check-in. And it seems like there's just been ripples of Charlottesville ever since. I mean, it has not gone away. Matter of fact, some of the organizing has kind of just increased in response to what's happened in Charlottesville. You know, famously, you had Tina Fey went on Saturday Night Live and talked about how you should just ignore them all and just go home and eat sheet cake instead, right? You know, to deal with the anger and frustration and all that. It was a funny bit for sure. But at least what we saw in Boston beginning there, man, people just did not go home.
Yeah, and one of the things I got to say about the thing out in Boston, you know, I was watching this on Twitter from the San Diego airport as this was unfolding, waiting to board my flight, connection flight out to Las Vegas. And, you know, one of the things I noticed last week in Boston, you had unions out there in full force. You know, I think it's one of the things you got to put out there. You saw not just people wearing their union shirts or their union flag. They had their flags and they had their banners out there, you know, and a lot of union representation from the teachers and other public sectors. And also probably your Teamsters were out there, too. But the photos I saw, you saw the public sector teachers, the SEIU and people like that, they were out there in force with their banners and their flags, you know, which is something that needs to start happening with these anti-fascist counter protests.
No, that's a great point, Sean. And it's something that is a kind of angle on it, too, that, you know, I'm telling you, did not make the media for the most part. I mean, you could see some of the shirts and the shots, but just in terms of how much of, you know, homegrown resistance there was. Like, this was not like a national mobilization to come to Boston, although people did come from like a lot of places. But the fact that you had so many people on the ground, people who are members of, you know, who are active in the Boston community, who are active in their unions, teachers, right, you know, government workers and things like that, saying, no, you are not doing this in our town. This is our Boston Commons, not yours. And we are going to ostracize you from the community. I thought that was pretty, pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think that might be a pivotal moment. You know, as much as Charlottesville might have been a pivotal moment, the show of force, the show of numbers that came out, you know, in Boston is really how you stamp out fascism. You know, you stamp these people out, you send them back to their underneath their bridges, inside their little internet communities, and get out of here.
No, and I think, you know, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report made the point where this was kind of like in some ways, an ideal scenario, right? That basically you have such, like, large numbers, right? You let them have their little permitted rally, right? And enough, you have such large numbers of resistance people out there, people who are kind of anti-fascist folks that are coming out against this kind of hate, that it scares a bunch of them away. You know, Richard Spencer and then, you know, the Baked Alaska dude and all these alt-right folks and other organizations kind of, like, bailed on, you know, Boston or any of the other rallies over the weekend to basically retreat to the internet. And they had this little tiny rally in the center, but it was completely encircled, literally like a giant circle, 40,000 people strong around this. You know, they're kept at their distance by police. And as Sam Cedar said, it's like, you know, it's like this is how we got to treat these. We got to treat these people like lepers, except without the sympathy for those people.
Exactly. No. And now here in Harrisburg, there's been a couple of times there's been counter protests. One of them, big ones, was like, you know, this happened back in November. You know, a bunch of like 50 neo-Nazis were rallying on the Capitol steps, and 300 counter-protesters showed up to drown them, to mute them out. Basically, their message wasn't getting across the street, right. You know, by all the yelling, shouting, screaming, the trumpets, the horns that they had playing, and the music they had going.
Yep.
You know, it's something we've been saying here on a long time for the podcast. You know, in order to fight this, we're done with going having these like unity rallies at these churches 2 miles away from the rally. No, it's time to confront these people in the streets, bring out your show of force, bring out the numbers, and outnumber them 50, 60, 100, or 400 to 1.
Right, exactly. And, you know, here's the thing is like what the situation in Boston showed too as well is when you've got that kind of numbers and that kind of like, you know, those kind of numbers, people turning out, that it doesn't have to, you know, it's not hand-to-hand combat anymore, right? It's complete ostracization and kind of, you know, threat by numbers in a sense, right? To say, we will not stand for this. And, you know, because, you know, Trump has been going out of his way to really, you know, do the whole blame both sides stuff. And you see that same kind of trope getting picked up and the right-wing media, Fox News, and all this stuff that want to equate what we are seeing in this neo-Nazi movement, right? The neo-fascist, the alt-right, whatever you want to call these folks, the racist, right? The white supremacist is that you got want to equate that with very small groups of kind of combative protesters, right? But then expanding that with kind of saying everyone who's anti-fascist. So you got the anti-fascist and you've got the alt-right, and they are both the same, right? They are identical, and there's violence on all sides, and they're all bad. When I would argue, at least like number one, they're not all the same, right? This is not equivalence, as we've said before, and we talked about last week a little bit. And at the same time, confrontation needs to happen, right?
You know, we were talking about one of the things I saw as a response to this was an article by Natasha Leonard in the Nation magazine, in the Nation online. And she has an article called Not Rights, But Justice. It's time to make Nazis afraid again. And she makes a defense of Antifa, you know, using mm-hmm. like they're not here to, you know, allow one's right to speech to happen. This is a tactic. This is confrontation. This is them, you know. This is them preventing speech from happening, and it's in the name of justice, not in the name of rights.
When you say them preventing speech from happening, you mean it's
preventing white nationalist speech from happening. You know, showing up and shutting this stuff down. Like that is their goal, is to shut down these protests. And really, they did a decent job in. I mean, if you look at the what the Antifa did, they did a job at shutting down the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis and Confederate sympathizers in Charlottesville. They didn't get to have their rally or their march that they wanted to have. I mean, pretty much like they forced the rally to stop from happening. And also, if you look at different reports, what was said on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now, you know, like the Antifa were there. They were protecting the clergy,
right,
and other community leaders from these neo-Nazis, from them actually engaging and trying to go after Cornel West or other people that were there as counter-protesters. You know, they were that buffer between the counter-protesters and the white supremacists.
Right. And we saw that, you know, and I think the fact that you saw that, you know, you've got, this white supremacist neo-Nazi dude, right, was willing to drive his car into protest, right? Was willing to try actively to kill people, right? Shows you why that kind of protection is important, right? You know, I remember, you know, look, any major kind of march I've been part of, like especially when you were doing anti-globalization stuff, where you're kind of actually locking down and trying to prevent say, delegates from going to the World Bank or the IMF or something like this. You're actually preventing a physical barrier. One of the things that you always make sure you do, you have marshals, right? You have people that are there to make sure that people are safe and people are protected, right? And in this case, and in that case, you're only talking about arrest or, tear gas and things like this for the most part. But there's always the idea that you got to, you're making sure you've got people there that are watching over to keep people safe. And when you're talking about people that are actively, I'm talking white supremacists who are saying that they want people to die, right? They're saying that black people, Jews, right, gay people do not deserve to live, right? Basically, that is a threat, a physical threat to death, right? It's no longer just about safety or scuffle or tear gas. Now we're actually talking about people who are willing to kill in order to enforce their agenda. And the fact that they show up alongside these militias, right, who are there fully armed, right, dressed in military gear with AR-15s and so on, right? That's their side of the fence. Right? You compare that to what you see a lot of stuff in Antifa, what they're doing, as you said, kind of protecting people, protecting the kind of the anti-fascist demonstrators is absolutely critical. And at the same time, right, they're letting these people know, you don't get to bully us around, right? Because we all know the only way that a bully stops bullying is when you smack them down.
Exactly. And no. Like when, like like there's a great point you made. Like their speech is hate speech. Your speech is violence. You want a certain group of people to not exist anymore. You know, degrees of violence is different. And you know, like this actually forced a lot of people to come out, like Mitt Romney and other Republicans, saying no, there is no moral equivalence here. One side wants to kill a whole set of people from the face of this planet, while the other side wants to stop that from happening.
That's right.
I mean, like this, like one of the things this forced me to do is watch documentaries, watch stuff on, you know, the Battle of Cable Street and other like major anti-fascist, demonstrations and counter demonstrations that had happened back in the 20s and 30s when fascism was rising, when this was happening. And, you know, like one of the things that I noticed from watching, especially with Cable Street, was the police have been on the side allowing these marches to happen, allowing these fascist marches to happen since the 1930s and since the 1920s and 30s in places like England and other parts of the world, actually, at this point. And, you know, one of the people that got was out in front of everywhere was Mark Bray, the person who wrote the Antifa, the anti-fascist handbook.
Right.
You know, he was making a lot of good points saying, no, fascism did not just start like as 40,000 people taking over a political party. It started out as people, 15, 20 people, 30 people meeting in this area, hashing out these ideas, setting an intellectual basis for their movements, and then going forward with them. You know, and his thing is you have to nip this in the bud as it starts. You don't like allow it to happen, and then like, because once you allow it to happen and it happens, then it's too late. And his defense is, no, what the Antifa is doing, they go after this from the first moments that they see this happening, because if you allow it to go on too long, then it's too late.
No, that's right. You know, I told you about this last week. It's a friend of mine, Ben. Ben and I are good friends from college. And we were kind of like, you know, punk rock guys, right? You know, we were kind of like part of the peace punks and all this kind of stuff. And this was up in Syracuse. And when we used to have these, you know, parties and things like this, and there were a group of skinheads, right? Nazi skinheads, self-proclaimed Nazi skinheads, that would show up, that would be on the kind of peripheral of the punk scene in Syracuse. And a lot of them would come down from, you know, from the different army bases and things. And things like this. I'll never forget this. And we'd have people show up at these parties and, you know, these Nazi skinheads and threaten people. And that would make, you know, a lot of people feel uncomfortable. And our original response to this kind of is try to, you know, kind of what you see getting played out right now was like, you know, nonviolence, we have non-confrontation, we're just going to try to talk them down, we're going to reason them to that and all that. But they had an increasing impact upon, you know, your sense of physical safety in the world, right? And we're like, you know, white kids with like mohawks and stuff, right? So, I mean, you know, it's a little inkling. Anyways, so there's this one party that we had at kind of this one major place we had bands playing and things like this. And these Nazi skinheads showed up again. They got into the party. and started threatening people again. And unbeknownst to us at the time, there was a group of people that came kind of with the band. I believe they came with the band, what Ben was recalling. And they're from Anti-Racist Action, right? And Anti-Racist Action was, again, doing the same kind of stuff that we see with Antifa now. And when they saw these Nazi skinheads, right, starting picking on people and threatening people, they went after them. Right. They went after him. Right. Started hitting him. Like, and these skinheads ran for their lives. Right. Because now for the first time, they were no longer the aggressors. And these ARA people, they chased them down the street. Right. And out of our lives forever. And that was a lesson for us. Right. Because we felt physical relief when we said, like, they're gone now. We've chased them away. We stood up and we fought back. And it got us having an important conversation in our really small community about, like, confrontation, the role of confrontation, and what we had been thinking about in terms of violence. Without ever thinking about their actions, these Nazi skinheads showing up, and threatening us as violence, and how do we respond to that? Because they kept on upping their game. And it's the same kind of principle that we say on the schoolyard bullies. If, you know, the bully's only going to be stopped when you put them in their place.
No, and this was a tactic within the punk rock community in the 80s and 90s, chasing the skinheads out of the scene. You know, like, when people think of Antifa, this isn't anything new. No, this happened in the 30s and 40s, and it happened in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, and it's happening again now. When it's a reaction and counter-reaction. You know, once people see this as a threat, the other side's going to react.
Yep, exactly. Exactly it. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, this is, you know, I think this is an important conversation. And, you know, I'm at the point right now is I'll be perfectly honest. I have mixed feelings about the aggressiveness of what we see with kind of some groups of anti-fascists, right? The kind of ideas showing up also with sticks going to go after the neo-Nazis and the fascists. There's part of me, like, on a personal level, right, that I'm all aboard that. You know, I'm like, yep, these people need to be put down, right? And at the same time, I'm also politically speaking what the consequences of that are. So, and again, I have both of those feelings at the same time. And what I'm very happy about, at the very least, is that this conversation is going on. At the same time, we're having a conversation about what kind of speech do we allow. Right. And this is, you know, some of the discussion that's been going on, you know, with the ACLU, about the ACLU saying they're no longer going to defend these neo-Nazis' right to protest if there's going to be weapons involved. Right. If the weapons show up, they will not kind of defend them. And it's forcing this issue about, OK, free speech to a degree. Right. When does speech become threat? Right. And at what point do we have to kind of really, you know, defend a particular vision of what this kind of country could be? Right. Those are important discussions to have. And I'm glad they're being had. And, you know, people haven't kind of gone into their, you know, separate areas and just kind of started hating each other yet. But it's an ongoing conversation. I think that's going to be really important if we're going to say that we want to make sure that, you know, we don't go the road of full fledged fascism.
Yeah, exactly.
So crazy. Now, one of the things that, you know, we mentioned before is that as part of this ongoing organizing, and, you know, we talked a little about this before the show today, there's this group called Refuse Fascism that has started, right? It's kind of a national network at this point. And they're calling for a November 4th occupation of public spaces across the country. And they're calling for regime change, right? In other words, to get rid of Trump-Pence regime. Now, what's really interesting about these folks is that they are a lot of the folks that, you know, they met in New York, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, Philadelphia, I think is the meeting is coming up this week, San Francisco, Austin, Texas, and some other smaller cities around the country. We've got to have meetings coming up. And there, a lot of the folks that are doing some of the organizing are using some of the tactics that we saw with Occupy Wall Street, except the distance, the time between when Occupy started and where we are now. These folks have been involved with the movement on an intricate basis and are super aware of, you know, a lot of the criticisms that they, even some of they themselves had of what happened with Occupy, right? Wanting to say tangible results, wanting to kind of build that kind of movement, and they've been learning ever since. And so now they've had a much more targeted purpose to occupy these public spaces, right? Calling for the end of the Trump regime. This is, you know, going to be really interesting because I think it is, if you look at this refuse fascism as a part of it, the fascism is really the, you know, the organizing principle behind this, basically saying as a community, we need to kind of stand up and kind of resist this democracy. So, you know, we saw what happened in Boston. There was resistance to Trump's Phoenix speech, which we can talk about if you want, Phoenix speech on Tuesday. And then now we have this call for November 4th, like almost a year after Trump and Pence were elected, to call for an end to their regime. It's a really wild time, Sean.
It's going to be really interesting to see where this goes. You know, I've kind of been surprised. We haven't seen anything like an Occupy style reaction over the past few months, even the past few years. You know, we've had a bunch of other movements pop up during that time. You had Black Lives Matter. You had the occupation with the pipelines, the Keystone XL, North Dakota Access Pipeline. You know, all these other different types of movements pop up, but you haven't really seen anything as like a mass movement that spread out across the country as the way Occupy did. It's definitely, I'm going to be skeptical to see how large this is, you know, I'm going to wait until it actually happens.
Sure.
But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see where something like this can go. Because I'm surprised this summer, the fights that were had, really legislative fights in stopping the ACA repeal. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Charlottesville and how these other movements are going to intertwine with each other.
Yeah, I agree. And I would push back a little bit on what you were saying there, too, as well. I do think there have been national movements. I mean, except, you know, you have had the anti-pipeline stuff has been going national, right? You mm-hmm. have Black Lives Matter has gone national, right? And I think that a lot of what has happened with these other movements since Occupy, is they've really expanded kind of what this movement looks like. What is interesting to me right now about this kind of refuse fascism call and some of what's happening now is that you've got the folks that, you know, the long-term activists that were involved with Occupy that have still stayed active have now been involved with Black Lives Matter, have now been involved with anti-pipeline stuff. And then likewise, the other way around. So now you basically, I think a lot of the important discussions have, or at least let's put it this way, some of the beginnings of the important discussions among these different kind of aspects of a broader political movement, those networks have been slowly becoming intertwined, right? I think the Bernie Sanders campaign helped bring this to the fore because now you also got the question about socialism, the role of socialism, the role of social justice from particular sectors of the left, and also having to question, you know, those movements are not allowed to kind of be separate now from questions of race and white supremacy in this country. And we cannot, you know, even talk about like, racial justice and economic justice without dealing with the fact that, you know, our climate is about to be destroyed and we have to put an end to these pipelines. These things are, you know, have slowly been meshing together. And I'm not saying here, I don't have my head in the clouds thinking that, you know, the movement is already kind of like great. There's no problem. There's tons of problems. But we have these increasing opportunities to rearticulate what this kind of the left is in this country. And that is encouraging by itself.
Yeah, it is. It is. And what I meant by like mass movement was like a lot of these movements that have spread across the country, you know, they've happened with issues surrounding police violence and stuff like that. And they've happened locally in those parts. When I was talking about like mass movement, I meant like a massive coordinated movement, not a coordinated movement, but like something that is happening all across the country at once in all these different cities. Like you had so many different Occupies going on at the same time.
No, like, I think that's like, true. I think
like a big show of like force, like, along those senses.
Right. I think that's true. But I think that what a lot of folks have been saying is like since Occupy has been also what was missing was the kind of, you know, in some ways, the protracted involvement with movement building. Right. And a lot of people learn that like in Occupy and through Occupy. So with Black Lives Matter, for example, is that, yes, it might be in response to police violence in these particular places, right? But the fact is that the national network of people, right, have been thinking about organizing and thinking about actions. That has been the work of movement building. If you look at Black Lives Matter, looking at their manifestos and things like that, they're incredible. Like, they're more far-reaching than I think most of the public even knows. And they were the first to, you know, I would argue, really articulate all these interconnections, right? What is, it's not simply just race as an identity politic or, you know, sexuality as an identity politic. They situated the whole gambit, right, of American culture, economic justice, racial justice, sexual justice, all this kind of stuff, and began to building that network. And that is impressive. And I think that only as now we see the rise of DSA and Socialist Action and a whole bunch of other organizations on the left that are beginning to kind of join that conversation, I can only hope that we don't see this, you know, factional fighting that the left is notorious for, but we have people that are committed to building the left, right, the broad left, and having the hard conversations and building concrete structures of organization. I mean, I think that's where we got to be.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I completely agree.
So, and on the other side of it, I mean, out of the movement politics for a second, the last, before we go to a break, I do want to touch on the fact that, you know, there's been these major moves at the national level that, you know, you had the Manufacturing Council, like all the business leaders from, you know, Trump's, you know, basically Manufacturing Council, which didn't do anything anyways. But those folks took off. But I think even more importantly, the right wings, the kind of the white supremacist guy in the White House, Steve Bannon, is out. I'm curious your thoughts on that. I mean, I got a whole bunch of things that go through my head about it, but I'm curious your thoughts on it.
I don't know. Sam Cedar had a really good thing on the Majority Report this week where Bannon might trying to be taken over some of the stuff with Sinclair Media, like put that out there.
Right.
But, you know, obviously he's going back to Breitbart. And is he going to go after Trump, or is he trying to forward that type of white nationalist movement politic across the country? You know, from being in the White House and knowing his experience there. You know, he's already reached out to Jeffrey Lord, who's, you know, a central Pennsylvania native and who has done a lot of different things. But it's going to be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, I think it's going to be something we're going to need to follow. And, you know, Sean has brought this up before about Sinclair Media. And I really think that we're going to have to, you know, I wish we had someone at Raging Chicken that was going to focus strictly on that stuff. Because what's going to happen with Bannon, what's going to happen with Sinclair Media, what's already happening with Ajit Pai, he's the head of the FCC, the moves that have been happening in the FCC to kind of deregulate certain aspects of broadcast, they are pointing in really, you know, really bad directions. And we need somebody to be following that stuff. So, but we'll come back. We'll, you know, Bannon is out. That's going to be kind of interesting. A couple things I want to mention before we go to break. Number one, it's kind of was a hinting on there too as well. So at Raging Chicken, we are looking to bring on two more writers. So if you are someone who wants to contribute to Raging Chicken Press as a contributing writer, right, willing to kind of contribute at least one article per month, then you can send me an email at editor@rcpress.org. That's editor@rcpress.org. Send me a writing sample and a little bit about why you're interested in writing for Raging Chicken Press, and we'll go back and forth a little bit about that. I could tell you some of what it means to be a contributing writer at Raging Chicken Press. I'm especially interested in getting someone that is based out of the Lehigh Valley, that's Allentown, Bethlehem, or Easton, Pennsylvania. And I'm also interested in someone who's willing to kind of dig in on the policy. I'll be honest with you, looking less at this point for commentators, right? I'm looking more for people that are willing to do some of the kind of reporting on the kind of political movements on the ground and some of the movements that are even happening nationally. So let me know. That's editor@rcpress.org. Get in touch with me if you want to contribute to Raging Chicken Press. We're really looking forward to bringing some more people aboard. Having said that, we can only do that with the help of listeners like you, people who are reading Raging Chicken Press or listening to this podcast. Remember that if we want to, you know, keep pulling no punches, you know, journalism going strong, we need members like you. We need people to join up, and we've got a special, the back to school special right now, now through October. If you join at the $10 per month level, I will send you a copy of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, as soon as it's published, which will be published in the next few weeks. Again, all you have to do is RagingChickenPress.org, click on the support and membership tab, and you're on your way. Thank you for all the members out there already who have been making our reporting and this podcast possible, and we'd like to bring more folks aboard. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this break.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. The year was 1877. That summer, during what came to be known as the Great Upheaval, police, the U.S. Army, and the National Guard brutally crushed a national railroad strike. The simmering anger of working people had many elected officials and industrialists on edge. One man saw the labor unrest as a business opportunity. And on this day in labor history, the treasurer of the Gatlin Gun Company wrote a letter to the president of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad with a proposal. He wrote, "We have the honor to suggest that you strengthen yourself now against such emergencies in the future by providing yourselves with Gatlin guns. Four or five men only are required to operate it, and one Gatling with a full supply of ammunition can clear a street or track and keep it clear. The six-barrel hand-cranked weapon could fire 200 bullets a minute. Upgrades to the gun soon had it cranking out an astonishing 600 bullets a minute. This ferocious new weapon set its sights on the cause of labor. In 1878, in Cleveland, Ohio, 25 prominent citizens formed the Cleveland Gatlin Gun Battery to deal with labor uprisings. Armed with two of the new guns, the militia drilled and held social events, but never fired the gun against workers. Militias from San Francisco to Connecticut, from Kansas to Pennsylvania, likewise armed themselves. Perhaps the place where the gun became most infamously used against labor was in the Colorado Mining Wars. In 1914, a Gatlin-type gun mounted on an armored car was used to shoot up a workers' tent city in Ludlow.
Miss Pavlichenko, well known to fame, Russia's your country.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
All time to come, 300 Nazis spelled by your gun.
Well, the voters up in Butler, they all say you can't be an immigrant, a liberal, or gay if you want to keep living the American way. Just don't dare compare us to the KKK. Daryl Metcalf, the man who feeds on fear.
Daryl Metcalf. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. That was, of course, the ballad of Daryl Metcalf. If you want to check it out, the full song, you can look at the link in our notes for today. An awesome little piece for Daryl
Metcalf.
You gotta love it. And Sean, poor little snowflake Daryl had a little problem with you this week, I guess.
Yeah, he blocked me on Twitter. I am now blocked by him on Twitter and Facebook.
Daryl Metcalf.
There he is. Big talking, big strong man, Daryl Metcalf. He just can't tolerate a little nudging from you, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't like when he's called a racist, I guess.
Well, you know, what are you going to do? You got to call people what they are, you know what I'm saying?
And you know what? It's actually been happening a lot lately with Daryl Metcalf. It's been more than a few people who've called him out for being a racist within the legislature, either on Facebook or up to his face. So, you know, a lot of people are starting to not get – a lot of people are starting to put the pressure on him. And he doesn't really like being called a racist, it seems.
Daryl Metcalf.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. That's good. So, good. So we'll just keep the pressure on Daryl Metcalf, everybody, because we do have a guy who's, is closely allied to the neo-fascist alt-right movement as possible right here in PA. And I think that you aptly put it, last week was that Daryl Metcalf is the crack in the Republican Party of PA's pipe. So
yeah, that is the tweet that got me blocked.
Well, you know, it's true. I mean, you know that, you know, the Republican Party itself in Pennsylvania has to keep on taking its hits on that pipe because they just won't go out and denounce him. And you know, I'd encourage everybody who's out there is like, you know, look, especially as this anti-fascist movement continues to grow, the resistance to the kind of Trump regime and so on. That, you know, you should be encouraging all your legislators to censor these people, to come out publicly and denounce people like Daryl Metcalf, who are closely allied with the militias, closely allied with this kind of alt-right, the alt-right in the state. So what can we say? But Daryl, you're a racist.
Daryl Metcalf.
Hey, he's a white nationalist, okay? There's a difference between a white nationalist, a racist, and a supremacist.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. As I was going to bring in, that's the audio that I've got. I want to get at some point. I want to get him talking about those distinctions, and we'll bring it in. But pretty crazy. I mean, Sean's been kind of reposted some of that stuff on Facebook recently, so go check that out. So, but aside from Daryl Metcalf, who's the kind of the sideshow freak that needs to be taken down, there's been some major developments very kind of recently. You know, we've been following this before, or you've been following this before with Senator Scott Martin, who's been pushing these anti-protest bill, and we've got some updates on that.
Yeah, so Senator Scott Martin actually introduced his anti-protest bill last week, Senate Bill 754, I believe it is. And basically, it's one of the worst written bills you'll ever see. It looks like a second grader wrote the bill, like who before they watched Schoolhouse Rock. I don't know if it could have gotten any better after they watched Schoolhouse Rock, but you know, it is one of the worst written bills I've ever seen.
And I'm doing the best I can. I'm doing the best I can.
And he is using this bill as a way of making protesters to pay for like police overtime and other expenses if they are arrested during a protest or some sort of action. And this is, you know, mainly focused on, his main thing is going after pipeline protesters, but this will have a chilling effect all across the Commonwealth. Because these protests have forced cities to start paying overtime for their police officers, especially in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, where you have seen other you know, consistent protests against Trump, Tuesdays with Two Main, other things where, you know, police presence is required.
Right. You know, I think that we've got to be clear that the direct impact will be largely felt on the left. Right. Because as we've seen is that there's these the anti-fascist groups that have been kind of moving forward. The police are generally protecting them and the arrests have been on the side of the left. Right. And that's what we saw down in Phoenix. Right. Is that where, you know, the tear gas was not launched at the racist and the white nationalist and the alt left and, the, you know, and at the people who love
Daryl Metcalf.
No, they were the ones who went after the left, right? And the fact that Martin has specifically been proposing this in response to anti-pipeline protesters, we're talking about, exactly as you said, a serious chilling effect being felt on the movement.
Not only has Martin did this to, not only is he introduced this bill, he's also having his own, like, little media campaign going on with this bill. By holding, seminars with state police and training seminars with state police and first responders as a way to deal with violence, from these protests. So really, he's also ingraining this like vision that these protests, all protesters are violent, into the heads of, you know, police, local police departments out in central Pennsylvania, which is also something that's, you know, pretty dangerous. And he's just doing it to get his bill, to get publicity for his bill.
That's a really good point, you know, especially since you reported on, like, in the city of Harrisburg, for example, attempts to basically get a whole bunch of new anti-riot gear equipment to kind of militarize a police force in Harrisburg. And we've seen this happen kind of across the country. If you start getting it in the heads of police officers, especially the leadership of different departments, that, the left is the enemy, this is that's not a good thing.
Yeah.
Crazy. I've got one thing to say to Senator Scott Martin.
Up your shaft.
You got that? So that's what we're going to do. Senator Scott Martin.
Up your shaft.
So one of the things that's been interesting in the wake of Charlottesville is that we've seen a gubernatorial candidate right here in Pennsylvania basically take the Trump road when it comes to condemning these fascists.
And who would that be?
I don't know. Senator Soprano, maybe? It's crazy.
Yeah, so this is actually really interesting. Senator Wagner was so after Charlottesville happened, a bunch of people made statements condemning the violence, especially mm-hmm. Governor Wolf, Paul Mango, who's running on the Republican side, Bob Casey, and like all these other people. Lou Barletta really hasn't said anything much. Pat Toomey hasn't said anything much. Scott Perry blamed both sides. You know, pretty, you know, taking the both sidersism route. And Scott Wagner stayed quiet until like Friday, mm-hmm. right, of last week. We really say he didn't want to get involved in a national debate and posting something on his Facebook page. And it was really like a haphazard response that Wagner released. You know, he said there's no room for hatred in our society. He believes in fairness and that there's no room for hatred of any kind in our society. And really, he then goes on to say that he did a lot of things for the Jewish community. He's done a lot of things for charter schools in the area, and that he didn't want to get involved in this national debate by Facebook or Twitter post. But really, like, the thing was, he pretty much like fell like one line short of that. He has a friend who's a person of color.
Right, right.
And like,
I've got, I'm not a racist, right? I've got a friend who's black. I had him over for dinner in 2003.
So, and then the next day he goes on and he publishes an op-ed in the in Penn Live, and you know, he acknowledges that the white supremacy, he acknowledges racism, he is a hoard into that things, you know, he's disgusted by that. And then he goes into saying, you know, he mentions the victim, you know, someone died here, and basically like goes into him going railing against Governor Wolf for throwing him into this pigeonhole of having to respond to white nationalists and the white supremacy that happened down there, and that somehow he was the victim of all this.
Well, he, you know, look, he's got a long history of victimhood. Let's not forget this. With one thing, when he was in one of his interviews,
management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype, and it's offensive.
See, I mean, he's still living that one down, Sean.
Yeah, and he wants to be treated with basic decency. And here you have someone who called union leaders, who compared them to Hitler and Stalin on the Senate floor. This is something he's going to take a baseball bat to the Senate. You know, like, and he wants to be treated with human decency, with basic decency. And here he's one to compare people to fascists like it's no big deal.
Yeah, well, you know.
I'm in a waste management business. Everybody immediately assumes you're mobbed up. It's a stereotype, and it's offensive.
Yeah, like bringing the baseball bat on the Senate floor doesn't help him out, right?
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, here you go, right? This is the guy, and it's the same battle that's going to be fought out. And I don't think it is surprising, and we shouldn't be surprised to hear this kind of garbage coming from people like Scott Wagner, and this, frankly, and now we're going to see the ramping up towards the 2018 election, right? Gubernatorial election, midterm elections, and this is going to be front and center because look, I mean, these were the forces that, you know, the fans of hatred that were fanned. I mean, the flames of hatred that were fanned in Pennsylvania that helped elect Trump. And, you know, Wagner and other folks in the GOP and in this state are trying to ride those coattails.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess the good thing is that, you know, there were cities all across the state that in response to Charlottesville that are, you know, basically digging in. And they're saying, you know, we're not going to make the same mistake again. Let's hope.
Yeah, no, we've seen a lot of responses from Philadelphia, Lancaster, Carlisle, Pittsburgh, you know, who all have had unity rallies. Harrisburg had a nice unity rally out here last week. You know, there's people across, even in, you know, Lancaster had 1,000 people. It's the second largest rally they've had in the past year. The largest rally Lancaster's has one in support of, you know, refugees back in the wintertime when Trump came up with his Muslim ban. Philadelphia had a few thousand people come out. Pittsburgh had, hundreds to a couple thousand. You know, they also marched through the streets on Saturday in response to a planned or a supposedly planned alt-right rally in support of the Google person with free speech, the same reason why the people in Boston were out protesting. You know, it's nice seeing, you know, Carlisle, which is not the it's a progressive area, but it's not the most progressive area in, you know, Cumberland, York County area region. It's, you know, it's a small city in a rural town, and that got 500 people to come out, you know, to speak out against the racism that was going on in Charlottesville.
No, right. I mean, we saw the same thing right down the street from me in Doylestown. I mean, Doylestown, you know, again, it's a, you know, it's a little bit more. It's the county seat of Bucks County, a little bit more progressive as a progressive, you know, reputation, and especially compared to some of the surrounding areas. But they've been, I mean, active right from the get-go since Trump's election. I mean, they had a I was there for a huge turnout for the Women's March back in January. There was, you know, a climate march that was out there. It was incredibly impressive. And they had people out there, too, in response to Charlottesville. So I think you're seeing these communities kind of getting active and staying active and growing and kind of building up on that. I mean, Rise Up Doylestown is, you know, for example, an organization that kind of came out of, you know, it's Indivisible, but a whole bunch of other organizations, too, as well. And you're seeing this kind of thing happen across, you know, across the state. And it's only going to be that much more important as we move forward towards kind of, you know, a really, really important midterm election.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how this energy is sustained, especially because of how gerrymandered the districts are out here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, again, I can't underscore how important it's going to be for people to really dig in on this stuff, and, you know, and keep the flames alive. I mean, one of the things that Sean was looking into this past week is that, you know, just came up just for an example. And I mentioned this in the, you know, in the intro today, is that, you know, Pennsylvania has the largest number of anti-government militias in the country. Right. And not only that, we have, you know, if you look at, we're like number five or something like this, five or six or something like this for in terms of number of the hate groups. We're seeing this increased movement for recruiting on college campus by white nationalists. They're all the kind of the same.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, you know, especially with the organizations like Identity Europa and how they've been organizing on college campuses. The response is going to be happening once the school year starts. You know, I think what you go back to school next week.
That's right.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if this thing starts up again, especially with the response of Charlottesville. It's going to be interesting to see how students are going to respond to this. You know, I've seen some articles arguing for a campus anti-fascist network, you know, on college communities, and seeing how, like, you know, Kutztown had a bunch of people come out. You know, AJ Marin did a really good job of organizing, helping to organize a rally, you know, speaking at a rally with Make the Road Pennsylvania. You know, there's all these groups that are happening out here in the Lehigh Valley and other parts of the region. It's just going to be interesting to see what happens and what the response is going to be if these people start posting their propaganda and their recruitment posters on college campuses again.
Well, one of the things that I was so happy to hear is that, you recall, back in last October, you know, my union, ABSCUF, the faculty at the 14 state university systems, basically we saw the birth of a student movement. That coming out in solidarity of faculty members who are going out on strike, but also against austerity and tuition increases and things like this. And they call the PA Student Power Network. And the PA Student Power Network, once that strike was over, they didn't just go away. Those students have continued to organize, and we've been reporting on that. They were active over the summer. They showed up at the Board of Governors meeting for the PASHE Board of Governors meeting. And just this beginning of this week, they concluded a statewide leadership retreat, basically setting an agenda for the next academic year, which is absolutely incredible. You had 14 colleges and universities show up for this, and this is not limited just to PASHE any longer. It's extended beyond that. 14 college university, over 30 students showed up for this kind of leadership training and agenda setting. That is a really good sign, because I can tell you, as someone who's been, one, was a student activist for years, and then has, as a faculty member, has, you know, very familiar with the cycles of student activism, is it's hard to get started at the beginning of the year. And very often what happens, students get organized, and by the time they start getting moving, it's like in October when they've got a good, you know, had their meetings and planning sessions, and then they really get moving, and then it's just the end of the semester, right? The fact that you've got a statewide organization, the PA Student Power Network, that has planning and is building networks of students across the country, and they're already ready to go, is is the most incredible sign that I can say, because you know, one of the things that piece I hope to be able to get this piece out before the start of school, my back to school piece is very much going to be about this, is we can count on that. And I've been listening to way much alt-right stuff lately, and to know that that is exactly what their plan is. Their plan is to go back to college student camp or college campuses and begin hardcore recruiting right as the fall begins.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see how students respond to that. And faculty as well.
Yeah, exactly. And faculty as well. It's like, you know, this is the kind of thing that we, you know, as faculty, this is not something that's just for students, right? And as staff members and as university administrators, it's the same, you know, it's a university, college, university campus is kind of like the microcosm, like just like any other community, is that you have to make a decision about what is this community about? Right. And it's not, you know, I'm sorry, it's not enough simply to say that we're going to try to protect ourselves from lawsuits by the right wing. That is not a defense of a community. Right. That is just looking after your budget. Right. And not that that's not important. Don't get me wrong. I don't like write that off. But at the same time, what is it, affirmatively, what do these communities stand for? Right. Affirmatively, who is the university and college university? And what, you know, from my purposes, one of the best things that came out of our strike last year was, you know, this whole idea of like, this is our campus. We are the campus. And that we meant students and faculty members together and anyone else that wants to jump aboard. Right. But this is kind of what the core is, that we are going to define the agenda. Right. That's the same kind of thing that needs to move forward. So faculty need to be out in front of this. Staff members need to be out in front of this. And frankly, you know, staff members need to deal with, you know, again, at any place, faculty members and staff members need to have those hard conversations with among their own members too, as well, especially in a unionized context. So here we go. You know, the fall is about to begin, and you know, we're either a part of this struggle or not, folks. So,
yeah. No, completely agree.
Crazy, crazy. All right. Well, we're coming up to a break, folks, and then we come back for the last call. You know, we'll talk a little bit about our president's, you know, attempt to stare down the sun during the eclipse, and some beer stuff, and get Sean's kind of California reflections. And maybe I'll tell you a little bit about my my deep dive into the alt-right YouTube this past week. So we shall see. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back right after this break.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new, sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. It's the last call. And here we are having a little fun and to wind up today's episode. And Sean, I mean, I don't know how you could have more fun than watching Donald Trump attempting to stare down the sun during the eclipse.
So I will have to admit, when it got dark out on Friday afternoon, I went outside of my apartment. I looked up at the sun for like a half a second, looked back down. And when I came back in, I saw the eclipse.
Of course you did.
I saw the eclipse hovering in the middle of my field of view as a little like almost like a hologram.
Yeah. You know what that is? That's called the stupid effect, Sean. I'm going to go up. I'm going to look at the freaking thing. Are you kidding me? You're telling me I'm talking to a guy who's no better than Donald Trump right now?
Well, I tried getting my camera to like really like focus in on it, but I only had my camera looking at it for like a second. I'm like, no, I'm not frying this thing.
You will too. I mean, that's it. I mean, if you read anything about it, right? If you watched any TV, if you watch any, like you were on Facebook, you should know that you can't do
I
these
love
things.
The link of the one guy, Jesus like he had like the guy who must be like in his 60s or 70s. I had to be in his 70s or like he had like the hat on, like your farm boy from like Illinois. And he was like, I stared at the sun when I got off the school bus in 1970, and I haven't had good eyesight since. Don't make the same mistake I did.
Oh my God! But I couldn't believe it. Look, I'm not going to excuse you. I'm thinking stupid. There's no way I'm going to excuse you for it. But you know, you would think that if you're the president of the United States, you would be extra cautious, right? Precisely because, like, all the cameras of the world are on you as you're watching, staring, like, you know, looking at the eclipse, right? And then you're basically setting the standard for everyone else. The fact that he looked up, Chris Hayes did this great thing, like, basically every single time that he looked up, there was a ding, ding, ding. So it was like six or seven times, I forget the number. And there's a few of them that he was like, you know, literally like looking it right into the eye, you know,
like
I'm going to stare this thing down, squinting right at the freaking sun. It was incredible.
Yeah, it was great. On social media, on the Facebook page, I posted a couple songs. One's Stare at the Sun by Thrice. They're like a punk emo band from the early 2000s that were pretty good. And the other one was Blinded by the Light.
Yeah, Doobie Brothers, man.
Yeah.
Blinded by the Light.
Which I think is like the best karaoke song ever. Like, it's just a good, like, but yeah, like,
I just couldn't believe it. You know, I actually had, I mean,
when I saw the picture of him like this and the hair flowing back.
Oh my God. It's like, and you could hear actually on some of the
don't
takes.
Don't look.
Yeah, you can hear, like, don't look. He's not. And you hear these like discussion. He's not going to put the glasses on. He's not. He's like, he's got them in his pocket. Right? He's got them, like, you hear like, I don't know if they're his aides or the media people where you hear these voices coming on, but I'm like, they're like, oh my God, he's actually going to look straight into the sun. I can't believe he's going to do this. I mean, we know he's freaking an idiot, right? And he's got all sorts of mental problems, but really?
Is that stupid?
We just briefed the guy on this again. We sat him down and we showed him the Fox News version of the "Don't Stare at the Sun" thing. So, it's crazy.
I can't believe. I don't know. Like the guy from Fox News said is the most presidential thing he's done. I don't know if he's being serious or he's being facetious.
I think he was joking. I think that the people that went after Tucker Carlson for saying that, you know, yeah, he's like praising Trump. I don't think. I think that was a total like super dry, like biting humor.
I thought it was pretty funny though, because I think you can obviously tell he was being sarcastic.
Yeah, I mean, like, I mean, it's at some point, I think, look, I am no fan of Tucker Carlson at all, right? I mean, at all. Even though he said some kind of pretty interesting things against Trump lately, but I just, that guy is horrible. But, you know, I mean, even for that guy, I mean, I he's totally, like, legitimate and being still looking at people and going, like, really? You actually think I'm actually serious about that? Really?
Yeah.
So. But that was funny. I actually had a really good time. We had my son had one of his friends over, and we built like must have been seven different pinhole viewers for it. We did have two of the glasses too as well, that, you know, like the ones that were actually proved to be okay and not some fraudulent ones that you're gonna, you know, end up seeing the eclipse in front of your eyes when you walk inside like some people. But it was actually really cool, and we had this one box. It was like this long, probably about 5 feet tall, and it was kind of fairly narrow. And that one had the absolute best viewing on it. And I had never done one before. I mean, I remember we had an eclipse years ago. I was probably high school or something like that. And I'd never actually used a pinhole viewer before. And the one we got with the, you know, that long box was awesome. Like, it was so good that you could actually see, not only did you see the eclipse really good, probably about the size of a quarter at the bottom of the box, but you could also actually see the clouds moving in front of it and stuff like that. That's how good the image was projected. So that was really cool. So that was a really fun thing to do with my kids and things. My wife was kind of like, it's an eclipse. What's the big deal? I'm like, really? But of course, you know, she texted me and said, yeah, we went out and looked at the eclipse. All right.
But, did she have the glasses?
What's that?
Does she have the glasses?
Yeah, she had the glasses too as well. But she called me anyways afterwards. Like, I think I ruined my eyes. I'm like, come on. She's fine for the record, everybody. yeah, so the kids were able to view it. My kids were really, you know, because they had the – this is the kind of thing that drove me crazy about seeing the Trump thing was because, you know, my kids – you know, they get little notices on their tablets when they're watching, you know, they'll watch their like little show or something. It's emphasized their daycare camp or their summer camp every single day. We talk to them about it every single day. It's everywhere. And they were like more vigilant than I was, clearly more than you were, about not looking at the sun. And they were just, you know, and they had a lot of, it was like a cool experiment to do.
Dad, the president, he's on TV, he's looking at the sun.
Well, yeah. And I guess the next one that's coming up in 2024, it passes is almost directly over where I grew up in Utica, New York, right? So so that we might make that a thing, right? Just to kind of go and see the full solar eclipse, that'd be kind of fun. So
yeah, one of the things that I'm actually one of the things that that I thought was like really funny, like I was at work, getting off of work, and the first thing that like popped up was the image of Trump like looking up with his hair pulled back, and I'm just like, "Oh my god, no, he didn't." And then, like, I'm watching the Sam Seder thing. I didn't realize he did it like six times or seven
times.
Yeah,
I know. It's crazy. Well, let me ask you: when you looked at Donald Trump on the screen, did you actually see his face, or did you see the eclipse that's still burned into your retina?
I didn't like stare. It's just I looked up and looked down, and
yeah, and did permanent damage to your eye. Yeah, it was no big deal. I just looked up, looked at the sun for a little bit, and I looked down.
Well, there's like, you know, glaucoma runs in my family. So, you know, there's.
So I'm glad you were extra cautious then.
What?
I'm glad you were extra cautious.
I was doing my own eye exam, trying to see if I could see any floaters.
Well, you do now. Crazy, man. So let me ask you. So, kind of now you've been back for a few days from California. So, you know, what's your takeaways?
It was really nice.
You loved it out there,
great,
huh?
I had a great time with my niece. You know, she was actually good for the 2 weeks. She was more well behaved than my dad was.
Although I have to say, your dad's got a history. I remember, I haven't forgotten the stories of Munich.
Yeah, I was the co-pilot most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, my dad is 64, 63, really bad with technology. And, like, if he wants to get a GPS system, right? And you know how the GPS tells you your turn's coming up?
Yeah.
They, like, for my dad, it should be like, hey, dumbass, you just missed the turn. Like, because, like, that was like the almost some of the experiences co-piloting with my dad, but it was fun. You know, because I'm like very like, all right, you have a mile to come up, you have 2 miles, and I'm like looking at my phone the whole entire time. Oh, there goes there.
Yeah, exactly. Negative negative yeah. Quarter mile, negative half mile.
it was a fun time. One of the things I noticed didn't talk about really last week. San Francisco has an ordinance where every employer must provide health care for their employees, right? So they have this ordinance for their employees where everyone is provided with health care. And, you know, it's really sort of like, it's surprising to see that out on the East Coast, you know, being from the East Coast, but I guess you could justify it by with the tech industry being there and how gentrified and regentrified the city has become. With all the money flowing through there, that yes, you should provide your employees with healthcare because of the wealth that is flowing through that city and through that region. one of the things we were talking about online was it was really weird driving through the Central Valley, which is pretty much a desert. And you're just like looking at it and it's like, yep, our food system is completely unsustainable. Well, like we're screwed if anything happens to it.
That was actually one of the things that I guess took me back. I mean, you know, is one of the things that
it's all desert. It's either like dried out alfalfa fields or greenwash pistachio farms right on the other side of it.
Well, that's the kind of the dual aspect of it, right? Is because on the one hand, I mean, if you look actually, you know, I did a lot of looking at topographical maps after kind of being there to try to understand it all. And you see that there's like, you know, you got your ridge, you got your mountains on, you know, right on the coast, basically. Then you got this huge open valley, the San Joaquin Valley. And then you've got, you know,
the Sierra Nevada.
The Sierra Nevada is kind of on the other side. And so what would under normal conditions, right, you'd have, you know, the clouds would go over once they hit the Sierra Nevadas, right? They rise up and they drop their water, right? And that's why that was such a fertile valley. But because of the way that the agricultural is done there, it just sucks all that water out. And so now you have all these, you know, so much of the kind of aquifers. Like, I finally get, like, visually got, like, how it is that that agriculture is so much of the issue with the water in California because of what it takes there, especially since you got a sustained drought. That, I mean, again, they had some relief from the drought this year, but the conditions are such that this is clearly not sustainable. And like the sheer kind of like mile after mile after mile of orange trees was just astounding to me.
Yeah, like, you know, this is where our food comes from, and if you're going to go after immigrants, that stuff's going to be left on the fields to rot, pretty much.
No, exactly. And you understand, like, you know, you see the whole migration. When you start looking at the maps after the kind of being there and kind of looking at, you can see that valley, San Joaquin Valley, extends all the way down to Mexico, right? And so you can see why this was a pattern of living. Before the colonization of, like, North America, you could see this was probably the pattern, right? Is that you have people migrating up and back through that valley as the seasons change, as things are growing, right? That was just kind of like a normal way of doing things, right? And I'm sure that you follow all sorts of livestock, but like animals and everything through that valley. And so then once you have the kind of one, the artificial borders that come into play once you have, you know, the kind of Western expansion of colonization. And then you've got all these kind of like, you know, really artificial barriers between peoples, right? So now we call these folks immigrants, even though it was part of Mexico at one point, blah, blah, blah. I mean, just a fascinating history.
Yeah. One of the things that's really interesting is how much the Mexican culture is still influential out there in California, right? It's mm-hmm. like, you know, you have a very large Mexican population out there, period. And, you know, like one of the things that I found really interesting was we went to Cabrillo National Monument in San Diego, mm-hmm. and that was settled or discovered in 1548. Right. If you think about the number of that, right, the Spaniards were in California by the 1540s. That was settled 60 years before Johnstown. Or is it Johnstown, Virginia? Jamestown. Mm-hmm. Jamestown was even settled, mm-hmm. which I thought like was pretty interesting. Like, you know, you hear about a lot about Jamestown is where the American, you know, colonization first started. But you really don't realize that California was settled 60 years before that.
Yeah, I mean, the Spanish colonized that whole area, right? They and there were people there before that. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, and that was not really ever explained in our history books. You know, you think Jamestown is like where the English settled, and that was it. But no, like the Spanish were on the West Coast for like decades before that.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right? I mean, it's like once you start kind of looking at all this stuff. It's cool. I don't know. It's like I'd only been to California a few times before, and it mostly been for conferences, and I didn't really explore very much. It was the first time I actually got to see different parts of the state. And we tend to do similar kind of traveling that you guys did, you know, not just like go to the city and stay there and hang out, but kind of check out the national parks, drive around, kind of see some of the, you know, the kind of sites and that stuff, and you start to learn a different history. So pretty cool. So what was I going to say? So I think I'm going to hold off. I'll mention this, and at some point I'm going to have to come back and talk about it. is that one of the things that I did over the past few days is I just got tired. I'm in kind of preparation for my for the fall semester to begin at Kutztown University, and so I'm doing my syllabi and things like this. And it was like, I don't know, probably like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I just like, I hit a wall. And I said, okay, I need to take a break. And I had it in the back of my mind for a while that we're dealing with some race stuff, talking about Charlottesville and some of my classes and things like this, and talking about social movements, kind of what I teach. But so I said, you know what? I keep on seeing these names come up and kind of in the alt left. Or I'm sorry, in the alt right. I can't believe I just said that.
Way to go there, Trump.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Eclipse terror. they have. And so I keep on seeing this stuff. And there was a mention. I don't remember what article I was reading. I was reading some article and it talked about there's been this question about women and the alt right. Okay. And so I said, yeah, that's kind of interesting because there's such a really messed up gendered politic on this too as well that doesn't really often get explained. That's really kind of like super hyper conservative, you know, woman stay home and take care of your man kind of crap also undergirds this whole white nationalist stuff, this racist crap. And so I did this, like I said, women in the alt-right, and I kind of searched that. And I came up with a whole bunch of these YouTube channels of these, you know, not just women. They're women and men, but there was, you know, this. I'm trying to find the name of. I can't believe it just lost the. I had it up here. Yeah, Tara McCarthy. All right, she's this alt-right YouTuber, and I clicked on this YouTube channel, and there's this. They have this show that's called. Let's see, what's it called again? It is called Reality Calls, which I'll talk a little bit about at some point. And as part of the promo for this, they're basically having she and this other woman, Brittany something or other, Brittany Pettibone, are interviewing all these people on the alt-right, not women and men alike. So kind of got, you know, this crash course in what that looks like. And I got to say, what's that?
I was going to say, one of the things that is really good about the Chapo Trap House podcast is they do an excellent job talking about these people.
Right.
Like, I wouldn't know who any of these people are, you know, unless it was for Chapo Trap House. And it's actually like got me to look into these people on YouTube, like see what their stuff is, like who, and you know, like it's exactly what, you know, they explain on Chapo Trap House. Like these aren't your yokels from bumfuck Pennsylvania who are poor. No, these are people living in subdevelopments, suburbia, really rich, probably have college educated. But master's degrees and stuff like that. These are really educated, intellectually capable people, you know, obviously like they're gaslighting and stuff like that or, and propagandizing, but they are, they're really intellectual. You know, they're not like these people with hoods on their heads who, you know, are picking the cotton or no pick, not picking the cotton really bad, picking like the farm
Trump.
Fields. That was a really bad mistake. No, they're not.
I'm doing
the
best I can.
Like, you know what I mean?
I'm doing the best I can.
Sorry.
They're not out picking the farms. They're not, you know, cleaning the manure. They're not doing those like low class farming jobs or lower class jobs you would a typical like, you know, KKK member you would like stereotype
right.
them as be doing.
Right. And I think that, you know, what I started to get a window into is like I understood in a very different way once I started watching some of these videos how they're effective on college campuses. Right. And like I mentioned this to you before, before we went on today is like, you know, there was this one scene where there was this one woman, I forget her name, but she was basically talking about what it means to be a real alt-right woman. And she talked, I mean, it sounded like some sort of like flower child hippie. Right, about needing to kind of like get on the ground and like touch the earth and get in touch with Mother Nature. And I'm like, holy crap. I mean, they're using some of the language and the way that they're talking about this stuff that are, like you said, either very kind of intellectual, right? Smart women, right, is kind of the trope, or kind of like, you know, earthy and things like this. And so if you are uninitiated into political culture and you're coming to college, right, you don't know that these people are radical racists, right? That these people are way off. And, you know, I've been listening to some other podcasts that are talking about some of the history of the alt-right and that kind of stuff. And I was listening to this one called Reveal. It's kind of an investigative news podcast, kind of PRX, I think it puts it out. And they were interviewing this guy who was talking about Antifa and the alt-right and stuff. And one of the things that he said in there was that he was he said that these people on the alt-right are essentially exactly the same in terms of policy. And I was like, you know, no, they're not. I said, but the distinguishing character is not their policy. The distinguishing character is their style, right? And the style is distinctively college, right? And that's why these people are in, like, professional class and that kind of stuff. These are not, you know, I think that on the left, there's still a lot of people, especially in the professional left, the kind of more established people, they have the idea about these racists as these knuckle-dragging Neanderthals, right? And that is not who these people are now. That is why I think that distinction with the alt-right is important, to recognize this as a different stylistic innovation of the worst of American racism. So I said more than I was going to say about during the last call today, but that was well, we're going to be talking a little bit more about this in the weeks to come. So crazy. So, Sean, are you working today, man?
Yes, I am.
Back to it, huh?
Yep. So, I worked a couple days this week already.
There you go. Well, I was happy to say, you know, I got to last week on the podcast. Remember, I had kind of had another special podcast. Sean came back a little bit. It was also Can Release Day over at Free Will. And they had Chasing the Dragon, which is their kind of like, you know, ever-changing, super hyped up Imperial IPA that I was there and I kind of got some of the can release. And I got to see Sean briefly the other day, drop him off a 4-pack. You liking it so far, Sean?
Yes, I am actually finished the 4-pack.
I was just about to say, is there any left? No wonder you were staring at the sun.
I wasn't staring at the sun because of the beer, okay? You know, I had a couple of the night before, but I wasn't day drinking. I actually had to go into work that day.
Okay. I'll let you go on that one.
Yeah.
But go ahead. Sorry.
I hope you are looking forward to that coffee I brought back. You know, Modern Times.
Modern Times, man.
Out in San Diego, they're a brewery out there. And they started off as a coffee roaster. And they started, and then they became a brewery. So they do all these really good, like, massive imperial stouts and stuff like that. And the coffee I brought back, you know, brought back two of the same bags, gave you one. Absolutely phenomenal. It's the coffee that they put inside their coffee stout. So
I'm psyched. And I just got, I told you, I just got my coffee grounder just kind of died years ago. And I actually kind of got a manual, like a manual grounder now, kind of like just so that I can have this coffee and other ones. Yeah, well, it's kind of it's
a little like grinder.
It's more of a top spitting one.
Okay. Yeah.
No, it's a nice one. It's actually it's kind of cool. There's been some, you know.
You're so hipster.
Is that a hipster thing? I just didn't want to have to plug something in. That's all. So that's, I'd want another freaking appliance.
You're saving the world one coffee turn at a time.
It wasn't my intention, but hey, I'll take it. So one thing then too as well, just to alert people, I mentioned this last week, but it's coming up this Sunday at 12 p.m. I think it's from 12 to 5 at Free Will Brewery in Perkasie, PA, or 12 to 8, I'm sorry, is their fourth Sour Sunday. And if you haven't been to the one, you're out there, that they have this Sour Sunday, there's going to be two food trucks. There's going to be Ollie's food truck is going to be out there and the Surf and Turf truck. If you go to the Sour Sunday, link on Facebook, you look for that. If you go to the, Free Will Brewing, you can find that event right there. Look at the Sour Sunday edition, number 4, 2017, obviously. So if you're around, and you got some time to go check out that, that's going to be a really cool event. Anything new in the world of Pizza Boy?
No, nothing really. Just same old, same old. Some nice IPAs that came out. The Legendary Orange is a really nice IPA.
Ooh, that sounds nice.
It's an orange IPA that has milk sugar added to it. That's really nice. It's draft only.
Oh, interesting.
And they're looking to can it in the future, it looks like.
Is that available through Crowlers?
Yes.
So you can get a Crowler. That's awesome. Yeah, I got to get to Harrisburg. I haven't been out there in a while. So,
and they also put a nice raspberry double IPA on. That's really good. Yeah.
Very cool. All right, well, that's going to be just about doing it for us now. Just kind of doing a little last news checkup for the day. That probably next week we're going to see what the result is of the Trump and McConnell-Ryan kind of battle that's going on. All the little drama around the debt ceiling that's coming up, and Trump is kind of going after again McConnell and Ryan. And also we've got what's promising to be at least a Category 3 hurricane is headed into Texas. It'll be the first time that Texas has a hurricane, I think, in about 8 years. So
it's good we have a FEMA director.
Well, that's what I was just going to say is like, you know, this is going to be the first major test of what's happened since that the Trump administration has basically gutted the EPA, FEMA, all the kind of, you know, the people that would be involved in both hurricane prediction and disaster relief. So like our hearts and minds are out with those folks in Texas as this as hurricane comes there. And I really, really hope that this is not going to be the first the major mass loss of life as a result of the Trump organization taking power. So we shall see. Anyways, Sean, man, the last days of summer are here. I go back to work next week. We should announce everybody that we're going back to Fridays beginning next week. Since I'm back to school, my Thursdays are now kind of completely booked up with classes. So we're going to be moving back to Friday. So look for us then. I'll probably be coming to you some Facebook Live making that announcement too as well. But Sean, have a good week, man.
I will. Looking forward to next week.
All right. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Don't forget, you can become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support and membership tab, and you shall be on your way. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, signing off. We'll see you next week, everybody. Keep up the fight. Keep strong. See ya!
Even the president saw it, but in a move that is not a complete surprise, he looked directly at the sun without any glasses. Perhaps the most impressive thing any president's ever done.
I have no clue what the fuck is happening.